This week in the Sutta class we talked a little bit about the five aggregates, five khandhas, and had a little look at how the suttas analyze these, define them. And we discussed a little bit about the different ways that the khandhas are perceived or understood in the Buddhist traditions. Very often in popular Buddhism these days, when people talk about the five khandhas, what they say is something like that thing which you take as a self, or your idea of a self, doesn't really exist, and all there really is the five khandhas. So it sort of puts these two things, the supposed self and the actual five khandhas, onto two kind of ontological planes, separate ontological planes. The self is an illusion, conceit, a fantasy, whereas the five khandhas are the things that really exist. Interestingly enough, in the sutta that we looked at the other day, it seems to be giving us exactly the opposite message, doesn't it? It's the five khandhas, which are like a mass of foam, like bubbles, like a mirage, like a magic trick. And if we look at the way that the five khandhas are taught in the suttas, the Buddha is not saying, you know, there's really not a self, all there is the five khandhas. What he's saying is that when you attach to a self, when you think about a self, when you identify with a self, what you're identifying with is actually one of these five khandhas. And what he points to is not the different ontological status of it, but he points to the it's more of an epistemological difference, that how do you know these five khandhas? When you know them in accordance with reality, yathābhūta, then you see that they don't work as a self. They're not good enough. They don't cut it as a self, as a soul, as something eternal, something that we can cling on to, something that will provide us solace in the face of the overwhelming reality of mortality. So this is really a different kind of approach. So the point of the Buddha's approach here is to encourage an investigation. And this is what we actually find constantly throughout the Khandha Sanyutta, these repeated passages that talk about the contemplation of the khandhas as being impermanent, suffering, and especially not self. So the point here is how you know these things, how you know them. Sometimes this can be a little bit confusing or difficult, especially with the khandhas, because it's not so obvious exactly what they are. When we look at the definitions and descriptions of them in the texts, that's one thing. When we try to apply that to our experience, then this is another thing. And it's also interesting that in different circles, even different meditation circles, these things are in some cases understood differently. For example, the Goenka technique, they take Vedana, the feeling, to basically mean the sensations which you're experiencing in your body. But this is not what Vedana is in the suttas. The thing which, what the Goenka people are calling Vedana, actually mostly would be categorized in the suttas as potthabha, is the tactile sensation, like the inner sensation of the body, which has, of course, its tone, it has a tone of being pleasant or unpleasant, and usually on that tone is the Vedana, but the actual sensation itself is not Vedana. Or, for example, in Thailand, sanya, perception, or we translate as perception, is in Thailand translated as kwam jam, which means just memory. It's a very ordinary word in Thai language, meaning memory. And that's an interesting translation. Certainly that sanya has something to do with memory. But when we're talking about sanya, perception of things, it's not, and the way it's treated in the suttas is clearly not memory as such. Memory as such is either sara or sati. And so even within the Buddhist traditions, there's some disagreement about what these things are, and these disagreements affect how people go about their meditation. And it's very important to notice this. And it's something which I think in Buddhist circles often we're not conscious of. I think we tend to be a bit in denial of it. We somehow think that our particular meditation teachers or teachings are somehow coming from a basis of direct experience. Whereas, in fact, the way people meditate, the way people direct and use their mind in meditation, is itself largely mediated by concepts. Even the very fact of meditation, the fact that we sit down to meditate, is because we hear the word meditate. We know what it is, we understand it through concepts, we use the mind to try to follow the meditation instructions. And of course this itself is an aspect of what we call sanya, isn't it? And so we've got a pre-existing idea of what our meditation is, and then we look and try to see that. And surprisingly enough, if we expect to see something, then we see it. And it's no coincidence that we're hardly surprised if I'm a Christian meditator and I meditate on the sacred blood of Jesus Christ, and if I have an image or a sight of Jesus in my meditation, that we're not surprised by that. This is how sanya works. And why should we be any more surprised? For example, if I do Dhammakaya meditation and I meditate on an image of the Buddha and reciting the name of the Buddha or something, and then that image becomes very clear and bright in our mind, we have a bright image of the Buddha, we should not be surprised by that. Or similarly, in some meditation systems where you meditate in accordance with the various categories of the Abhidhamma, and you meditate in order to realize the supposed nama rupa as defined and elaborated in the Theravada Abhidhamma, and then that's what you see. That's what you've been conditioned to see, you've been programmed to see that. So this is all quite straightforward, really. Now, when the Buddha was talking about the five khandhas, I don't think, personally, that he was really telling us so much what to look at in meditation. Although the five khandhas can certainly be used in that way, we can take the five khandhas and we can try to work out as best we can what they mean. We sit down in meditation and then we can go through each one. And this is, you know, a perfectly good meditation technique, and it's used by forest monks in Sri Lanka and other places. And we actually have the basic framework of the five khandhas in mind, and then you can use that as some structure to your meditation. And so this is one of the ways that we can develop our vipassana meditation. So for example, you sit down and you want to investigate the five khandhas, so you sit down and you investigate the body, the rupa khanda. And so you sort of ask yourself, okay, what in my experience, what am I experiencing now that's physical, that pertains to the rupa khanda? And you can feel, you can experience your body, you can experience the heat and cold, you can experience the shape of your posture, you can experience the sights and sounds, perhaps the smells as you're sitting there in meditation. So all of these are part of the rupa khanda. And then you can take your time with that and just saying, okay, this is what is the quality of experience like? What does that feel like? What is that rupa like? You know, when I'm sitting here now, I touch the floor with my foot, I can feel the slickness of the floor, the slight cool feeling of it, the pressure of it if I push my foot on it. So this is all part of the rupa khanda. Yeah, so investigating those physical, the tactile dimension of experience. And so once we're clear about that, we can then investigate according to the three characteristics. Okay, and if you want to just use one characteristic, you can, or you can use all three. And so again, once you've got a clear idea of those things, then you can investigate, is that permanent or impermanent? Okay, and so you go through each aspect of your experience and ask, is that permanent or impermanent? The pressure of my foot on the floor, is that permanent or impermanent? Well, it's impermanent, it's changing. And the feeling of my hand on the wood of the chair, is that permanent or impermanent? The sounds I can hear, is that permanent or impermanent? And the sensations I can feel inside my body, is that permanent or impermanent? So we keep on just going through each aspect of that physical dimension of experience and just reflecting on each one. Is it permanent or impermanent? And just constantly, this is a way of reminding ourselves of that thing, of our question of impermanence. Okay, and then we can then go to the next characteristic of dukkha. And so investigate, is that dukkha or sukha? And so this is a bit more subtle, because of course some of the sensations we feel might be pleasant. Maybe it's a warm day, we're sitting, and then we feel a cool breeze coming across our face as we're meditating. Oh, okay, well, it feels, you know, it's quite a pleasant sensation. But the dukkha as a characteristic is not the feeling of dukkha. Okay, that's part of the second khanda, the khanda of Vedana. So what dukkha means here is it almost like dukkha, or almost has a meaning like, oh, is it imperfect? Is it does it cause unsatisfactoriness? Does it is it suitable for providing some kind of lasting or really meaningful satisfaction? Something like that. And so, again, you don't have to, you know, determine that in your mind, okay? But you have to be open to it. It's an inquiry. So you kind of ask about these things. So for example, you know, that sensation on the floor, and say my feet on the floor, and you say, is that sukha or dukkha? And just investigate, what does that sensation feel like? One of the things that you notice, for example, is that sometimes the mere presence of sensations is something which is a bit disturbing or a bit stimulating or a bit distracting for the mind. And when those sensations die away, then the mind's more peaceful. And so you can see that's an aspect of dukkha that's involved there. Or another aspect is that the dukkha of is involved with the question of impermanence. So when you hold a particular posture, for example, you try to hold your body still, then it becomes painful. No matter what posture it is, there will always be some pain involved. And so whatever you do with your body, there will always be some kind of dissatisfaction or disturbance involved. Doesn't mean it's all like that, but just means that that's part of the experience, is inescapable. And the last one, anatta. Okay, this is a self. And so one of the basic questions that to ask in asking if something can be a self, then ask is it, can you control it? So one of the terms for the self in the Brahmanical scriptures, it always talks about the antarayami, the inner controller. Okay, so the antarayami is the one who just manifests the world as they wish. And so, well, is that possible when we're looking at ourself, a physical experience? Is it possible to just have that be as we want? Can we change our form when we want it? If we're sitting in meditation, something's uncomfortable, can we just change that? If we're finding it difficult to keep our posture straight, can we just decree and just have it be like that? And of course the answer is we can't. If we're feeling cold, can we change that? No, we can't. And so we're looking at that question really, can I be that thing? And all the different aspects of the physical experience, can I be that? Is that good enough for me to actually be that thing? And when we look at it, we realize that it just doesn't work. So you can spend as long as you like doing these contemplations. There's no prescription on it. If you feel, you know, that you just to do a few minutes on each one, then you just go through a few minutes on each one, and then that's fine. Or if you feel like a particular aspect of that sort of resonates with you in some way, then just pursue that. And so you get some kind of feedback from it sometimes, you know, you really connect with it. And so if you feel that connection with it, then just go. If you feel like it's maybe dry and not getting anywhere, then maybe move on and contemplate a different aspect. And so then go from there to, if you feel that you've contemplated that rupa enough, then you can contemplate the vedana and go on, and the pleasant, painful or neutral aspect of any experience. Yeah? And so you can investigate that. Sanya, you can investigate. The way we recognize, interpret experience. Yeah, you can investigate that. So, for example, maybe you hear a sound and your mind immediately says, oh, that's a bird. Right? So, the sound is a sadda. Yeah, this is just an impression of data. And sanya is the one who creates a concept and recognizes that sound and says, hang on, that's a bird. Yeah? And so this is what we're investigating as we're sitting there. This perception, the perception of me and my body sitting here. Perception of how do I feel, what are my emotions. Yeah? Perception of when thoughts arise, how do they arise or where do they come from. Yeah? Why do certain thoughts carry this kind of emotional charge and others don't? Yeah? So associations with different people. If I think of one person, then that makes me feel good, it makes me feel happy. If I think of another person, it makes me feel angry and annoyed. If I think in a certain way, then the mind becomes gentle and loving. And if I think in another way, I become depressed and become bitter, alienated. Yeah, so this is something like connotation of mind, kind of working through these connotations backwards and forwards, the connections between things, the resonances between things. So this is that realm of sanya. And again, you can investigate these things in terms of anicca dukkha anatta, impermanent suffering not self. I should mention that in the Pali scriptures, it's always impermanent suffering and not self. In the Sarvastivadin scriptures, they usually add sunyata to that list, so they usually have four characteristics, emptiness being the fourth. Where in Pali, the emptiness is usually treated as equivalent to not self, but certainly at least very similar in meaning to not self. In the Sarvastivadins, they use emptiness as a fourth characteristic, called the four Dhamma seals. So if you want, you can use that. And of course, it's described in many different ways in the suttas. It's not just, you know, these three are the most common ones, but there's a whole kind of list of different ways of contemplating these things. Some of them it gets pretty dire sometimes, you know, contemplated as a boil, a disease, a dart, an affliction, alien, and so on. So you can go through that whole list if you want, or whatever is suitable or means something to you. So this is one way of contemplating the khandhas and contemplating the aggregates. Now you can see that this particular technique is heavily conditioned by our concepts and our ideas about what the khandhas are. Okay, it's taking those categories, ideas, concepts that we've learnt about through studying the suttas, reading and talking about Dhamma, and then applying that in quite a literal and straightforward way in our meditation. So in a way that's creating within our own mind, in our contemplation, similar structures to those structures which we find in the teachings and in the Dhamma. Okay, and so it's reinforcing that connection. And so that's very useful. That will help to clarify many things. It will help to clarify our understanding of the Dhamma, our understanding of the teachings, and the connection between those things and experience. And so that has a lot of usefulness. Yeah, it's a very powerful and very important way to practice. We should all do some of that kind of contemplation. Of course, the limitation of that is that we're still caught up in those concepts. Okay, we're still caught up in the understanding of what is the five khandhas, what is sankhara, what is vijnana, and our understanding of that will differ depending on our own ideas, depending on the teachings we've been exposed to, between our own level of understanding and all of these things, and that will change. That's very conditioned. So in investigating the khandhas, investigating experience in vipassana, a lot of another approach to meditation is to not use those kind of categories at all, okay, and to not involve that kind of conceptual structure or framework of the khandhas. And so here we're talking about the approaches to vipassana which are more based on like mindful awareness. I was almost going to say bare awareness, but you heard me, my opinions on bare awareness just the other day, so I'll try to avoid that kind of trap. So this is more like the practices like, say, Mahasi technique, which was my basic meditation that I learnt, and things like similar technique is taught by my teacher Ajahn Mahachakchai in terms of it calls Jitben Glang, the mind in the middle, this kind of contemplation, and various other approaches to this. It's not, again, not dissimilar to the as I understand it, to the Dzogchen practice of just sitting, or the, I think it's the Zazen practice of just sitting, just bare awareness. I think probably most meditation traditions have this kind of practice in there in one way or another. So in this kind of thing, we're not contemplating, we're not utilizing or consciously involving any conceptual scheme or set of categories of the Dhamma. Okay, so we're not thinking about the five khandhas or the satipatthanas or anything like that. We're not involving them. We're not structuring our meditation according to those things. But we're structuring a meditation according to a particular awareness of stuff. Okay, they call it the technical word in Pali is vikendaka sankhara. So you can use that if you like, or you can use the word in English is stuff. Okay, and basically it means just whatever happens to be arising and is the most important or dominant feature of awareness at that time. So in Mahasi technique, you kind of use the rise and fall of your belly as an anchor. So that's your kind of primary object. You focus on the rise and fall of your belly. Watch that arising and coming down. But whenever anything sort of grabs your attention or anything arises, such as, say, a stream of thought comes up, or you hear a sound, or there's a sensation in your body, or something like that happens, then you turn your attention towards that thing, and then you note it, trying to note it clearly and simply, but staying with the actual experience and not going beyond that. So, for example, if say Bhante Bulhasan in walks out of the room and slams the door, you don't say, "Bulhay slamming the door, Bulhay slamming the door, Bulhay slamming the door," but you just note sound, sound, sound. Okay? Right? So, and again, if you're thinking about something, you don't sort of note or investigate what you're thinking about, but you just note thinking, thinking, thinking. So you just keep very clearly to the actual reality of what's happening. Okay? If you're feeling a sensation in your leg, you just say feeling, 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 or pain, 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 or something like that. Not getting involved in it. And the purpose of that noting, it's a very skillful technique, and the purpose of it is to cut through the story. Okay, this is one of the main purposes. It helps to direct your mind to an experience or something that's arising as it arises, and cut through the story and concepts about it, and just direct your mind to the thing itself. So this is a very useful technique. And so in that technique, the focus on the rise and fall of the belly gives you some stability in your concentration, and then the looking at awareness of the different kind of objects gives you insight into the questions of impermanence and these kinds of things. But you're not thinking about impermanent. You're not sort of looking at it and saying this is impermanent. Right? You're just noting it. It's just an awareness practice like that. So this is one way of doing that. Other ways of doing it, like the way Mahachachai teaches it, that you don't have that basis of watching your belly go up and down, but just purely just being bare awareness and noting the stuff, the vikendaka sankhara, as it arises. So that technique, you've kind of lost that centering thing, and so you're more open. And it's interesting how these things always have their checks and balances. Of course, one of the reasons in Mahasi technique why you use the belly is because that's a primarily vipassana approach, so you don't have a distinctive separate practice for developing concentration in samatha. Whereas in Vayajan Mahachachai teaches that you do have that basis of developing samatha through anapana or through metta. And so when you come to do the vipassana side of things, it's not so necessary to use that. You've got other tools, separate tools for developing peace of mind and concentration. So then when you come to do the bare awareness practice, then hopefully that gives you enough clarity that you can do that without drifting around too much. Of course, that's the problem with this practice. If you're just doing bare awareness with no particular object in mind, then it's very easy to just drift off. But essentially, that's a similar practice, and we'll accomplish a similar kinds of things. And those kinds of practices can go very deep. When we do them just a little bit, then like any meditation, when you do them just a bit, they tend to remain quite shallow. It's quite on the surface, and as you go further and further and further, then it will become quite transformative. If you stick with it for long enough. So this is like another approach to doing vipassana practice. Another approach again that's used for developing the vipassana and the insight into the khandhas and so on is used in the Thai forest tradition, and that's usually or often they kind of do a number of different things, but two of the important things that they do is one is based primarily on body contemplation. So one investigates until you can see and get a clear apprehension in your mind of either the whole body or a particular part of the body. So for example, commonly they'll teach the contemplation of the skeleton. And so you contemplate until you can see the skeleton, the bones, everything clearly in your mind, go through that, investigate all the different parts. And when you're clear in your mind with that, then you play around with it. Okay, so you're playing with perception. You can start, for example, you can take your skeleton apart, take all the bones apart one by one, and then lay them on the ground in front of you. Yeah? And when they're all apart on the ground in front of you, then you can look back at your own body and it's empty, and the skeleton isn't there anymore. Yeah? Or you can try changing the color of the skeleton, or you can try burning it, so you can put your skeleton onto a fire and burn it all up until they become ashes, and then let the wind blow them away until there's nothing left. And these are some of the kinds of imaginative exercises which the Thai forest tradition really excels at and does a lot of. And they'll continually, one of the characteristics of the Thai forest tradition is that they don't just focus on just doing one method, but will continually adjust and play with the way that they're approaching it so that it stays fresh. And this is one of the aspects of that tradition that I really like. And I remember reading in one of the stories of Ajahn Mahabua, and I can't remember in detail, it was a long time ago I read this, but he said he reached came to a certain problem in his meditation. And then he tried something to address that problem, and it worked, it was quite successful. And so his meditation then proceeded well after that. Then sometime later, a similar problem came up. Yeah, the same problem came again. And so he remembered that in the past he'd done this particular meditation approach that was going to solve that problem. He thought, well, he'd do that again. So he did it again, and it didn't work. Yeah. So it's just the same problem, but you try to apply the same solution. It doesn't work the second time. Yeah. The mind changes. Yeah. Things are not the same, even though they might seem like they're the same or seem similar. And so the techniques which work for you in one case may well not work for you in another case. Yeah. The very fact that it's happening again already means that it's different. This is part of what impermanence means. Yeah. So in the Thai tradition, they will constantly be playing with these things and using different techniques to investigate these things in as many different ways as possible. Each way, you're constantly reminding yourself of these. Yeah. And I asked Ajahn Dhan about this about this meditation, and said, he talks about there's like a shift between what they call sanya and panya, is like perception and wisdom. So like you can see these things, yeah, but it's still kind of this, it's just an idea about them, it's an idea about your body or something like that. How does that go to wisdom? Like, you know, they talk about you keep on contemplating them, and the sanya changes to wisdom, it deepens and it becomes wisdom. And how does this happen? And he said it happens as the defilements in the mind disappear. And so what you're contemplating, the object of what you're contemplating, stays the same, but your inner qualities of your mind change. As you keep on doing this, the ignorance is getting whittled away. You're seeing reality, coming closer to reality, closer to truth, again and again and again, reminding yourself of these things again and again and again. And this is whittling away at ignorance, and as ignorance whittles away, the wisdom kind of grows naturally as its complement. And so this is how that gradually shifts from perception, from sanya to panya, from perception to wisdom. And then that points to the second very important wisdom practice, which is emphasized a lot within the Thai forest tradition, which is what they call the one who knows practice, or puru, or one who knows. And essentially what that means is just it's similar to like a bare awareness practice, just being aware of whatever arises, except it's more, the emphasis is more subjective. So it's not so much like Mahasi technique tends to be more object orientated. You're aware of the belly or of various things out there, and it gradually moves towards a more subjective awareness, but the orientation is more objective. But in the Thai forest tradition, the orientation from the beginning is more subjective. It's more the contemplation. How is my mind? How is my mind responding to these things? Objects can arise there, but how do I relate to it? So it's more your response to and involvement with the objects is more important. And as I understand, I haven't practiced this technique, but I understand that this is more how Shwe Om In Sayadaw's practice of Chittanupassana is as well. It's a similar, like a subjective emphasis. So this also is a very good practice, and I think this is a very profound practice, and is important for developing deep insight. That for developing deep insight is not so much about knowing what are these particular external objects, but knowing about how the mind is responding and being involved with those things. Now this brings us back to the point I raised at the beginning: is like how is this involved with those kind of categories or concepts of the five khandhas when we're being aware of things in this way? One of the most important things about the five khandhas is not the particular definitions of each khandha. One of the most important things is the interrelationship between the four khandhas and the fifth of consciousness. So the four khandhas of form, feeling, perception, and sankharas, so volition. These are all said to stand against the aggregate of consciousness. Okay, and so there's this interaction and this responsiveness, this resonance between the inner subjective awareness and then what was called the savijnanika kaya. This is a phrase we read in one of our suttas, the savijnanika kaya, the sentient body, this inner sense of awareness, embodied awareness, and then this bahidhaja sabhanimittesu, so the external signs, which is the four other aggregates. So you have this kind of inner and outer interplay and resonance and interrelation. And that is actually where the essence and the depth of Vipassana practice starts to emerge. And because we're seeing not just simply that this or that object of our experience is permanent or impermanent or whatever it might be, we're not just investigating that, but we're investigating that the very nature and structure of experience itself is interdependent and is constantly wheeling and spinning around. Yeah, and this is how the Buddha used this. This is where that, you know, we have this idea of the rounds of samsara, the circle of samsara. That's actually where this phrase arises from. Specifically, he's talking about the circling and the whirling of the interrelationship between consciousness, between awareness itself, and the things of which we are aware, the objects of awareness, that whirling around and interdependence of these things. And of course, as always, that can be investigated on any level. It can be investigated on the ordinary everyday experience that we're having now. It can be investigated in terms of a microscopic, tiny experience on an atomic level, or on a cosmic level in terms of samsara and the evolution of the universe. The same round is happening, the same spinning is happening, and also that same spinning constitutes the wheel of time. It's that very interplay and involvement which is constantly playing back and forth and back and forth, feeding back, evolving, changing. And that itself is what constitutes time. And so we infer from this to the past and the future. So this is where this is called anbhaya jnana, inferential knowledge. It's another aspect of vipassana, which we can do both either literally and consciously, or we can do just intuitively. But if we do it literally or consciously, we can ask ourselves, this experience I'm having in the present, I can see this interplay of consciousness, the objects of consciousness whirling around each other, yeah, like two butterflies. They use the simile in the suttas, they use it like two sheaths of reeds leaning up against each other. But I like the simile of two butterflies. You know, if you've seen the butterflies doing a mating dance and they kind of circle around each other. So this is the image that really I find very, very interesting. It's like vijnana nama rupa. The sabhijnanika kaya, the sentient body whirling around all the external signs, the external limiters. And that structure of consciousness was the same in the past as it is now. It's the same in the future as it is now. Can we imagine the possibility of a consciousness that exists without that interplay, without that resonance, without that interdependence? Yeah. That is the very structure of consciousness. And so this is where, when we're starting to appreciate this, we're starting to unravel experience at the more deep levels. And so again, this is something which needs to be investigated again and again and again and again. Yeah, if we are one of the great disciples, if we're, you know, someone like Sariputta or something, then you know, we get a few short teachings and do some meditation and then boom, we become an arahant. If we're not, then we need to really kind of grind the lessons home again and again and again and again and again. And we do that on all of those levels by listening to the teachings, by studying the suttas, by memorizing the suttas, by applying the suttas consciously in our meditation, by internalizing those structures, by practicing with them again and again and again and again, by investigating the nature of the experience, the objects that we're having in awareness, by investigating the nature of awareness itself, and by investigating the nature of the round and the circling of these things and the interplay between them. And as we investigate that on a deep level, and as the mind starts to perceive this on a deep level, it will start to withdraw or to drop or to let go of these things. And that again is, you can experience that in many ways. You know, sometimes you just experience it like the whole, everything just falls away. You just feel like the world falls away, and you feel like a body of space. So that your body, instead of being solidity, is a body consisting of space, and like the air is just flowing straight through you, and the world's just dropping. What was the floor underneath you is just a well, and just blackness that goes down as far as you can see. It's like kind of sometimes the experiences of emptiness, or you can experience it like the stuff. It just loses its solidity, and so it just sort of comes in and out of the mind, and you feel like a great distance between yourself and those things. Just watching. There's no sense of disconnection between them. And just kind of watching. In some cases, some stages in the development of vipassana, it's normal to have a particular kind of physical or mental reactions and responses to the meditation at different stages. Okay, so sometimes you can feel this kind of feeling of like the body crawling. You can feel this kind of almost like your body has become a mass of maggots or something, and or leeches, and it just crawls from the inside. Yeah. It's kind of, you feel like your body's like a slimy mass of leeches. You can feel a sense of kind of despair that comes over when you're like seeing the darkness of samsara. You see that, you feel that despair can come over you, or you can feel a sense of just incredible restlessness, like you're just needing to escape. I just have to get out. Yeah? This is one of the reasons why sometimes in the vipassana retreats, they're quite they try to stop people from leaving because they recognize that you know, sometimes people don't leave because they just want to leave, but they leave because they're actually reached a point in their meditation. This desire to escape has arisen, but it's not matured yet, so it's mistaken. You take it, it's called wanting to leave the retreat center instead of wanting to leave samsara. And in what Rampung they used to call it, the bagpacking knowledge. It's a level of development of insight. And so what they would do at that time when people came and they had that kind of thing, they'd just say, okay, that's fine, you can go, but before you go, let me give you just a particular meditation technique I want you to do before you leave. And then they'd give a series of meditation exercises, which actually had nothing to do with anything, right? But as far as I could tell, right? That's just my inference, but that the purpose of it was just to get the person to sit there and go through those things, and by the end of it, then that feeling of restlessness had faded away and they're actually happy to continue. And so this is quite a skillful means that was used for that. So all of these kinds of things can happen, and many others, you know, these are just a few. Many other kinds of things can happen, different kinds of emotional responses, memories come up, all kinds of stuff. And you need to be able to contain these things, okay? So it's okay. It kind of gets into the area where it's a bit dicey or a bit difficult to judge. Actually, in many cases, you can have quite extreme experiences in meditation. It's perfectly okay. One of the tests for that is simply that the experience stays within the boundaries of the meditation itself. Okay, so if you have these kinds of intense feelings and so on and so forth, and then when you finish your meditation, you come out of it, and those feelings stay there. Yeah, you may, of course, you'll feel some residue or hangover from it, but basically if the feelings stay within that context, then that shows that it's probably safe enough. If they start to obsess you and become too much, and they're not left within the boundaries of the meditation, that's a sign that the mind's losing balance. So then you need to stop, you need to back off. And just stop meditating for a while, just go for a walk, just calm down and so on. But this is also another reason why it's important to have the balance of samatha and vipassana, and that if our vipassana goes too far, too deep, too quick, then the mind can become unstable, and so it need to come back and then sort of do some breath meditation, just do something very calming. And so the alternation of these things is very healthy, very good for the mind. So when you're doing this vipassana, no matter what technique you use, what approach you use, at the end of the day, you'll leave all of those techniques behind. Okay, those techniques are just a set. Meditation technique is nothing more than a set of skillful means which is trying to help you to move your meditation in the right way, that's all. When the moment of realization comes, whether it's a little realization, a medium-sized one, or a very deep realization, that will be naked, and it will arise not as an element in a scheme or a technique. Okay? So this is one of the reasons why I believe in the Thai forest tradition they don't really teach things like this sort of complex scheme of vipassana jnanas and the different knowledges. They're more interested to get people to respond in an intuitive and mindful way to whatever happens. Okay, not so much interested in schematizing the whole thing. So when that moment happens and you see that awareness or that truth arising, then it's important to stay with that. Okay, don't make anything out of it. And this is where the stability and equanimity and mindfulness that we've developed will come to play. If the mind sort of drops and there's an awareness or an insight, the mind sort of penetrates. And if there's not stability enough, it'll tend to react. The mind will get excited, or it'll get fearful, or something like that. And then that will jerk you out of that realization. And so it's that stability of concentration and equanimity at that point which will be most useful. So then the truth opens up, and then you can stay there and just stay and watch that. And you can hold that. So this is very important. And then as that goes deeper and deeper, you will not need techniques, and you will not need the concepts and the teachings and all of those things. They will still be there, they'll have directed you, they'll have done their job, and then you'll be just there with the truth and be there alone with the truth. And at the end of the day, that is where our practice must take us. No matter what you're doing, whatever practice you're doing, whether lay or monastic or where you are, whatever school you're in, tradition you're in, whatever kind of meditation you're doing, at the end of the day, you're sitting there alone, face to face with the truth. And so our practice, the things that we're doing in our life, the purpose of those things is to prepare us for that moment. In that moment when we are just there, awareness, truth, are we ready for that? So this is my little talk for you this evening on Vipassana meditation and the five khandhas. So I offer this to you for your edification, and I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions.